When they show a dog on TV, do you try to get your dog to look at him? Don't you want your dog to see the dog on TV?
I do.
Look at the doggy. Look at the dog over there on TV. Look. They don't look. They won't look. Even if you try to twist their head around and point it toward the TV, he ain't going to look. Over there. Turn your head. Look on TV. Look at the dog. God damn it, you asshole. Look at the fucking dog. They never look where you want. If you point at something, they just stare at your hand. You try to show them something interesting, they think you're showing them your hand. There he goes again, showing me his hand. Why does he do that? I guess he's really proud of it. Uh-oh, now he's twisting my head around. Oh, Jesus, what did I do now? Well, for one thing, you completely missed the dog on TV.
Well, there he is, the Pope of the Bunker. George Carlin. Yeah, man. Did you hear the tick-tock, tick-tock? Do you know what that means? Oh? Well, you better start thinking about it. Here we are in the bunker. Terrible Tommy right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station. And that's right next to our Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard. We recondition them, repaint them, patch up the bullet holes, and you come on down here and pick your heavy equipment up and sneak it out here in the middle of the night and get it home and hide it someplace. Yes. All that stuff we're bringing back from the Middle East, man, we're going to have an ISIS army here, only it won't be called ISIS. It'll be called Terrible Tommy's Spring Offensive. Yeah. It is October 28, 2014. Yeah. If you don't have it done by now, your grand plan, well, you're going to be out of luck for this month if you don't get going. Got a couple of days left. Hey, we get to play Halloween. Whoa, a good old pagan holiday that the Christians stole and used like they do everything. And then the claim it's about their Jesus. It tickles me, these churches that don't like paganism. And then think, that's evil. That's the devil. But they have Halloween parties. They dress up and have Halloween parties. Just like they hunt the eggs on Easter. It's another pagan holiday of ours. And then they want to use it. That ain't fair, man. We should have, you know, we really screwed up when we didn't copyright Halloween and Easter and Christmas. Boy, we'd be rolling in dough, man, if we had. Well, here's the weather report as we usually give you. And today, here in the Midwest, in north central Indiana, we've got rain. Rained all night last night. In fact, I had a little bit of a security excitement here last night. All of a sudden I'm hearing one of our alarms go off on the downstairs door outside the bunker, and that just doesn't happen. Well, I grabbed my .45 and crept down the stairs, turned on my floodlights in the yard, and simply we got a big wind from the east, which doesn't happen that much, a heavy wind from the east, and the door was not quite locked, or I mean it hadn't set right when I closed it, and the alarm came on. I thought, wait a minute, that's the first time that's happened. So anyhow, all was clear. Well, we had chains and everything on the door anyhow, so even with it opening ajar a little bit, it wasn't going to come all the way open, and nobody's going to get that door open unless they hit it with about a 300-pound guy's foot. Well, they could do that, I guess. But anyhow, I crept back upstairs, put my old .45 away, and everything was fine. But I'm telling you, never go inspecting a possible security problem without a fully loaded gun in your hand. That doesn't mean to go crazy and start shooting anybody in the neighborhood, but it does mean this. If you go to inspect a problem, and there is a real problem, and you don't have a gun, you're screwed. It's all over. So you got to be ready, even though it's a false alarm. And too many people do that. Charlie, will you go check the door? Okay, honey. Without a gun, or without a knife, or without a sword, or without a guillotine, man. You got to have something, because it can happen. It can be 100 times, 1,000 times, no problem, false alarm. But it only takes once until you be dead. Now my very official webmaster has sent me some... She feeds me stuff all the time, so a lot of the stuff I send out to you is the hard work of our webmaster. Yeah, and we've got quite a bit on security. There's a program coming out of Japan now. It's not quite ready to buy, and I got to find out how much it costs. That's supposed to really give you some security. Of course, I don't depend on that kind of stuff myself, but you might want to look into it. Lots of things coming out from other countries. Yeah, so those boys over in Japan are pretty hard to get around on electronics. Well, yesterday I played for you a tape of a show about how they actually have commercial outfits now setting up white women with black babies. And, you know, that immediately, to a white heterosexual male that has any racial consciousness, it's going to upset you a lot. A lot. But there's two sides of the coin. Now, you wonder what's the woman thinking about. But, you know, she's not altogether to blame, even though it's a hellacious crime against the race. Here's something I cut out of the internet that seemed fairly interesting for both sides. Quote, where have all the good men gone? And I've heard women saying that, and I agree with them. Where have all the good men gone? Because I look around, and boy, I'll tell you, even for lone wolves, I don't see many that I would want to lone wolf with. Their male peers often come across as aging frat boys, you know, like football geeks and all that, maladroit geeks or grubby slackers. A gender gap neatly crystallized by the director Judd Apatow in his hit 2007 movie, Knocked Up. The story's hero is 23-year-old Ben Stone, who's played by Seth Rogen, who has a drunken fling with Allison Scott and gets her pregnant. Ben lives in a Los Angeles crash pad with a group of grubby friends who spend their days playing video games, smoking pot, and unsuccessfully planning to launch a porn website. Allison, by contrast, is on her way up as a television reporter and lives in a neatly kept apartment with what appears to be clean sheets and towels. Once she decides to have the baby, she figures out what needs to be done and does it. Ben can only stumble his way towards being a responsible grown-up. Well, I agree with the women on this. Like I say, my lady and I go out, you know, once a week, maybe twice. And I don't see much out there that if I was a good-looking woman, petite and clean, would want to link onto. I mean, we've got these super fat guys, and it doesn't make any difference what day of the week. They go out with crummy clothes on and a baseball cap turned around and everything else. I've seen a lot of this where a beautiful gal is in tow with some guy that looks like he should be in a homeless shelter. And talking to these guys about race, they can't get past just saying, oh yeah, those niggas, you know. If you can get anything out of them, it's just, yeah, those niggas are bad, you know. But then I'll see them turn right around and sing karaoke rap songs. And when they do that, I leave the place. There's one place in particular. It's a pretty nice place. It's in a hotel. They have karaoke on Thursday nights. And invariably, there's some white asshole that starts singing rap. And I either do one of two things. We either leave or I go to the bathroom until it's over. I hate that shit. And every red-blooded white man who's racial should. Because they're just mimicking and copying the Negroes. I mean, you know, they all want to be Negroes. They all want to be into negrophilia. Well, then it goes on down here in this article, which gives the other side of the story. As we can tell, between the crap media is trying to cram down our throats and our own personal experiences, it's not a good time to be a heterosexual male these days. Well, especially if you're a clean cut and you're racial and you cut your possibilities way down. If you come right out and tell a gal, well, I believe in racial separation, watch how fast she takes off. When I go out, which is admittedly fewer and fewer these days, all I see is dumpy women and thirsty men who will date and pay for any woman that gives them the most minuscule of attention. This isn't just in the social interactions that happen between men and women. It rises up all the way to our interactions with the local DMV, tax agencies, police, and any other situations we're forced to deal with in our surrounding bureaucracies. We're supposed to sit back, put up with all kinds of abuse and not say anything about it, and just deal with that shit. Not me, even though in the end, given where the culture is going, it's going to bite me in the ass. Fuck it. I've done what I intend to do in this life. Everything else is gravy. There is a solution, however, to all these ills that we will surround us, that's surrounding us, and it's extremely simple and extremely effective. The math works, and if it became viral, what we have surrounding us would quickly crash and burn. Now, I hadn't read this part of this, so I have no idea what he's going to go into, so don't blame me. I have no illusions that what I'm about to propose will ever happen in my life experiences and travels, but what it's worth. I'll throw it out again. Deny them. Sounds simple, but in practice, but it's not. And I have no illusions that it will ever happen, given that the worldwide indicators predict a slow decline rather than a horrible crash. So far, I agree. But I realize that there are some out there that might want to know what I mean by the phrase, deny them. Some are easy, like being an attractive male and never dating or having sex with a woman that approaches you. I've had a hell no attitude for a while, multiple times. I've been asked why, because you think you're a special snowflake? Fuck that. But think about it. If a majority of men had that attitude, the problem that is radical feminism would quickly disappear. See, the only reason that this crap has integrated itself into public life is because most men will bang anything that will bang them back and will put up with any shit that these same women throw at them. Imagine if the majority of men said to themselves, fuck this, and given the proclivity of women to need a dick on a regular basis, this problem would quickly solve itself. I'm sure a lot of women would disagree with that. I think women have far more self-control than men. Another effective strategy is to deny any taxing authority the theft of your money until they come to you for non-payment. This is easier than you think it is for anything other than property taxes. If you live in a large metropolis, ignore away. If you live on a little island like me, pay those and ignore the rest. The only good thing the Republicans have done is to cut the IRS budget. I'm not going to incriminate myself, but let's say I know someone who's been following my advice for the past 3 years with no repercussions. Well, I might add to you that the best thing to do is to become judgment-proof. Own nothing. I mean nothing of any significant value. And that's Tommy's advice. I found that out when I lost just about everything I had in the Portland trial. I said, I'll never do that again. I'll never own a house, or I'll never even own a car. What else can you deny them? Well, for one, pay for everything in cash. That's good. And I'm not saying in a fraudulent pieces of paper that you get from your local ATM. I learned this lesson the hard way after my last trip to Vegas, when I had around $4,000 of paper cash in my pocket when I went through the TSA checkpoint in the airport before I boarded my flight home. Put the cash in my checked baggage? Hell no. It wouldn't have never made it back with me. Put it in my carry-on? Hell no. They would have stolen it right off from under my nose. So I put it in my cargo short side pocket. Went through a bit of shit, but I got to keep my own money. Since then, I've been putting my cash in various prepaid cards. They're cheap, and as long as you don't have a bunch of the same ones, it looks like you are carrying a bunch of different credit cards, considering the average American has 4 different credit cards. This makes carrying cash easy. 6 prepaid cards at $1,000 each will pretty much get you anywhere and anything you want. There's more that we can deny, and I'll write about it in future posts. If you have other suggestions, I appreciate them. Appreciate the comments. Well, that was a good article, and as far as I know, the person may not even be racial or anything like that, but it's good common sense. And so anyhow, and don't hang out with these bums and these jerks and these football crazy and basketball crazy people. I'm not saying it's necessarily wrong to go to a game once in a while or watch a game once in a while, even though I can't understand people that claim to be racial separatists, and a lot of them actually hate the black race, that'll spend all that money and support these Negroes in high fashion while they're out screwing white women. Both basketball, football, and anything else they can get into. Now, I just can't see that. I have never supported professional football or basketball. Part of it is I'm just not that interested in sports. But to go and pay these prices, or even if it was free, to watch a bunch of niggers running up and down a field, you know, reminds me of that Andy Griffith song. Actually, it wasn't a song. He talked about it. I played it once on here, but anyhow, the logic escapes me. So anyhow, that's my position. I think that you can go to maybe a high school game, usually not so bad. But nowadays, all the schools are getting integrated, even high school. If you go to a football game, you're cheering for partly white guys and partly Negroes and whatever other race is in there. So I feel guilty supporting anything that's mixed race, as far as that's concerned. The only thing I might be a little bit in disagreement with is putting money into these cards. Now, they may seem quite safe, but I don't think anything that has any connection to the system is safe. I think I'd prefer keeping it in cash and like that. Of course, if he's going to places like Las Vegas, well, carrying a few thousand bucks in cash, of course it's going to draw attention to yourself. Anyhow, there's many ways to secure your cash, and I'm not going to go into them all now. I think Slingblade has gone into them once in a while on his show. I saw on Walk Talker Alerts a little bitty here that said something about where is William Pierce, the George Lincoln Rockwell, Tom Metzger question mark. I don't know half of these alternate right jags. I think that the list of kosher conservative pseudo-racial realists, well, then they go on to recommend Rush Limbaugh, Pat Buchanan, and all these conservative false flag proponents. I don't understand where these people are coming from. But I guess I'm not on their list. At least their good list. Let's see. It's called Eradica. Eradica. .wordpress.com. So, anyhow. Well, normally I don't do much of this stuff because I'm not in the right wing. But it's interesting here, an article that came out on the net. Eating their own, several feuds erupt among white nationalists. Well, what they mean is right wingers. And, of course, it's what I say always happens in the right wing. And that's why the right wing can never really get anywhere, because they know that they don't want to do anything physical, so they take up their time arguing and fighting, usually over personalities. The article goes like this. Over the past couple of weeks, the so-called academic racists, whoever that is, of the white nationalist movement. Number one, I'm not a nationalist, so that leaves me out of that. Have set academics aside and instead devolved into an online battle in the style of the Hatfields and the McCoys. Nothing new about that. Ever since the 60s, they've been doing that. In the wake of several recent events, including the arrest and deportation of Richard Spencer from Hungary, in the state senatorial campaign of Kentucky neo-Nazi Robert Ransdell, some of the biggest names in the white nationalist circles are taking sides and taking turns publicly skewering each other on their respective websites. Well, number one, I had never heard of Richard Spencer, and I could give a shit less whether he got deported from Hungary. And the other thing was, Kentucky neo-Nazi, who sounds like a total false flag operation, Robert Ransdell, running as a write-in candidate. Of course, you know you can't ever get anywhere doing that. I did it once, thinking, I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but anyhow, it's crazy. I don't know. This guy sounds like he's been created right out of whole cloth, right out of Hollywood. But anyhow, he's on a different ball diamond than me, so let him go. White nationalist and neo-Confederate, oh jeez, Brad Griffin, a.k.a. Hunter Wallace, compiled a list of beefs among white nationalists and posted them recently to his Occidental Dissent site. One commentator noted the easier list to compile would have been who isn't fighting whom. Well, I'm not fighting anybody. I just declared my independence from the whole right wing. I don't pay much attention to them. And indeed, from the length of the list posted, the commenter may be right. Now, see, this is I don't know what, this is a left winger of some type writing this article, and they're just as bad. The long list includes familiar and ongoing feuds such as those between longtime supremacist Harold Tubby Covington and, well, everyone, as well as those involved in the Vanguard News Network, VNN, Glenn Miller's haunt, the great Glenn Miller, who can't tell the difference between a so-called Christian and a so-called Jew. Actually, you can't in most cases. Founder Alex Linder also with pretty much everyone. However, there are many new and unexpected conflicts within this movement that ironically calls for the need for solidarity in its mission. Well, I'm trying to figure out what the mission is. In particular, unexpected spats have surfaced between several well-known white nationalists, including Greg Johnson of Countercurrents and Richard Spencer of the National Policy Institute. Both are hailed as academics by their peers. Beware when somebody starts saying they're an academic. You know, like a PhD piled higher and deeper. We got quite a few of those running around. In fact, one recently had a meeting over in Europe, of which seems like every time I try to go there, or one of my friends, real close-in friends do, they get tossed in jail. But some right-wingers seem to be able to travel throughout Europe and no problem at all. It's interesting. Andrew England of increasingly popular neo-Nazi site Daily Stormer, well, I can understand that, because if you put out the most really vicious shit on the Jews, that attracts attention. I don't think it gets you anywhere, but it attracts attention. Meanwhile, has been engaged in a war of words with Colin Little of the White Nationalist Alternative Right. Never heard of it. This is getting like the Klan. There are 15 million names for the Klan now, you know. The day of the one KKK has been over for a long, long time. Anyhow, a site that was originally founded by Richard Spencer, and I guess I'm just way behind times on this Richard Spencer, unless he's going by a different name. The site was abruptly shut down by Spencer in 2013 after Little, who was based in the UK, took its reins. Well, I don't see how you can be much of a white nationalist and still survive in the UK, all the anti-hate laws and so forth. Johnson-Spencer conflict emerged in the wake of the near collapse of NPI's conference in Budapest. Wow. Johnson canceled his plans to attend the requested a refund of registration fees from NPI. When the Hungarian government threatened arrest and deportations of its attendees. Well, wait a minute here. Oh, despite the fact that several of the events, most noteworthy names among them, representatives from the Jobbik, the hard right Hungarian Nationalist Party, you know, I find very little real white racism among some of these parties in Europe. You know, they're called racist a lot of times, but when I read their writings, I don't see too much of the type of racism I'm concerned with. A pro-Russian favorite of traditionalists in the European New Right had withdrawn. Spencer and others journeyed into Hungary to be met by police at the event. Spencer was rewarded with several nights in prison before being deported and banned from returning for several years. Yeah. You know, I found some of these pro-Russian people to be a problem, too, whereas I have a certain amount of sympathy for the Russian position, even in Ukraine. But in having chats with these people, they appear to be more just Russian nationalists than white racist. They have this strange respect for Putin. And I respect some of the things Putin says, too. But you can't trust any of these leaders. You can't trust them, man. Reminds me even George Wallace down in Alabama. When George Lincoln Rockwell went down there in the 60s and he wanted to have a little demonstration in the park, George Wallace, that great racist, had his state police round him up and shove him out of town. So when it comes to state or national leaders being eulogized by me, leave me out. none of this sat well with Johnson. I hope that's not the Johnson I knew from California. Let's see. He had a lot of money. Made his money selling real estate to the Japanese back in the 80s. That's probably a different guy. The final straw for me, he commented on Occidental Descent, was Richard's disastrous mishandling of the Budapest conference. Why in the hell would you go to Budapest to have a conference about white racism? Or is it like it is pretty recognizable? It'd be totally just a Jew question. Just a Jew. A good share of these people that are all for going after the Jews don't want anything to do with straight out white separatism. They avoid me like the plague, I know that. And when you say nigger on the show, you'll never see him again. When a foreign government tells you that your conference is banned and that the police will take the necessary steps to make sure it does not take place, you do not vow defiance. No, I would say you get on a plane and go home. He's got personal and another comment when he said Richard is basically being dominated by Nina Nogudnik, his Russian-Georgian wife. Well, welcome to the crowd, Nina. I never heard of you either. Johnson also penned a post and multiple comments at his own website, CounterCurrents, and attacked Spencer for his handling of the controversy, particularly his failure to adequately warn attendees of the risks involved with entering Hungary. Of course, what do you expect? Another feud erupted about the same time over Robert Ransdell's campaign for state senate in Kentucky. Ransdell, a neo-Nazi. I never seen him declare he was a neo-Nazi. I don't think he's a national socialist either. I think he's just a conservative. He's been posting signs that state, "With Jews we lose." White nationalist comedian Ramsey Paul took exception to Ransdell and openly condemned his campaign. Of course he would, because if you trust the Pauls, you're nuttier than I am. I know, he says a lot of the good words, so did his dad, but they're just politicians. We've been sold down the river a million times by these guys. Ramsey Paul, Paul Ramsey, oh, I guess that's a different guy, has other supporters in his opposition to Ransdell. One writer at white nationalist Robert Whitaker's Bugs site snarked that Ransdell's borderline comatose with juice you lose is the latest drooling from the comic book pro-whites. Boy, these guys really don't like each other. In the same article, Whitaker attacks Stormfront, the world's largest online white supremacist forum. And the most popular hangout with the FBI, CIA, and everybody else, calling it a vacuum for white, pro-white energy that is spent arguing on the internet, and said that he and his followers, known as Bugsers, who bombard various websites with variations of the mantra, a white supremacist statement that claims anti-racism is anti-white, are the only ones who work for the cause and have visibly destroyed anti-white memes that would be there forever if it had not left to tens of thousands of Stormfronters. And then neo-Nazi Andrew Anglin, another person I never heard of. I guess I've been away quite a while from the right wing. Whoa, got a bite here. And then neo-Nazi, and their favorite word, it means nothing. Andrew Anglin entered the fray of beasts with a massive roundup post at his Daily Stormer site entitled Infinite Drama Quest, in which he adds extra snark by representing each feuding party as different anime character from the series Dragon Ball Z. Wake up out there, I know you're half asleep. To Anglin, all the battling over what's best for the movement. Well, you know what the movement is, like Dennis Mahan said, it's a bowel movement. Anyhow, he says it's ridiculous because his approach is the best. There you go. Quote, you cannot preserve the white race without addressing the Jews. You cannot address the Jews without addressing their hoax. You cannot address their hoax without addressing Adolf Hitler. I don't see why not. That statement opened up yet another beef with Colin Little at the alternative right. Well, let's face one thing. Hitler was a Germanicist. His main goal was the Germanics of Germany, and Germanics that may be living in other areas. He didn't seem to care much for the American whites. In fact, a lot of his propaganda was against the Klan and so forth. And if you don't believe it, plenty of cartoons that they put together putting down the Klan. So trying to turn Hitler into a specific hero of the Aryan struggle, I think is a mistake. And they might say, well, why do you think that? Well, he was dropping bombs all over white people, and they were dropping bombs on him, but he didn't try to get out of it. I mean, he was bombing white people all over, white working people all over Europe and Russia and England. So that don't sound like too much of white racial separatist to me. Anyhow, that statement, okay. What Anglin is unequivocally saying here, writes Little, is that before you can do anything at all about preserving and protecting the white race, stopping mass immigration, say, or encouraging white women to have at least 2.1 babies, you must first get everyone to love Hitler and hate the Jews. And if you can't accomplish these supposed preconditions, then you are best forget the whole shebang. So what he is really saying is simply, you cannot preserve the white race. Well, I agree with the guy. I mean, you shouldn't have to have swear allegiance to Hitler or a lot of this right-wing stuff if you're trying to work to save, so-called save the white race. You should say the white working class of the white race, not the predatory capitalists. Because they're the ones that want to get rid of you, and they're the ones that are getting rid of you. But these wars, like Hitler and all these people were involved in, and there was no innocence on any side, didn't lead to the health of the white race. It killed millions of white people. Like a tennis match, Anglin hit back, calling Liddell my super Martin intellectual guy, super smart intellectual guy, and claiming that he could turn Liddell's arguments around on him, but wouldn't ever do that because he has this thing in his back called a vertebral column, which physically prevents me from being capable of engaging in such base intellectual dishonesty. Boy, these guys get pretty heavy here. Okay, and not one to avoid controversy or attention, white nationalist Matt Perrott of the Traditionalist Youth Network was willing to throw out some more gas on the fire. According to Perrott, who normally shies away from comparisons to Nazism, the flaw in Anglin's model is that Nazism isn't radical enough. Well, that's probably true. Not according to my standards of what needs to be done in this country. Meanwhile, over in the Vortex, that is VNN Forum, Alex Linder is so worked up that he is posting 1,000-word screeds at a rate that is almost unprecedented for him, even though he's known for long diatribes. Among these are attacks on almost every major figure, including Johnson and Spencer, involved in a beef list. on Occidental descent. Stand by. We're about to the end of this shit. Everybody feels Greggy, writes Linder, in a number one infighting beefs and so on thread on VNN forum. Then piously he lifts his eyes heavenward, shakes his head nobly and sadly, and earnestly swears to soldier on and do better next time. So do Jesus-y. In the same breath, Linder attacks Spencer, comparing him to Kevin Alfred Strom, a disgraced former National Alliance leader who is a convicted sex offender. Spencer is simply a nebbish. I think of him as a Stromlight. Less brains, less character, even, unquote. Like some kind of surreal white supremacist vision of a telenovela, the drama continues to unfurl, as Brad Griffin suggested at Occidental Descent, some popcorn might be in order. that was funny. Well, you notice they didn't attack me. I'm not even in the ballgame anymore, and the Jews don't even talk much about me, except that dreaded lone wolf shit. We know where that came from. And we're just waiting for one false step, and we're going to get him. Anyhow, so much for the right wing. I won't be commenting on that anytime soon. I don't know these guys. Almost none of them I know. None of them I really know personally, even the VNN earners or so forth. But the left wing do the same thing. They go at each other like mad. There's a million fractured elements to the left wing. Some of them we agree with a lot of their stuff, and some of them we don't. But for the left wing writer of this article, the race mixer, who wrote this article, he better look under the skirts of his left wing if he wants to see problems. I think there's even more factionalism in the left. Well, now that I've bored the crap out of you, I put you to sleep. Let's close out here with the last few minutes of the show with Leon Trotsky. There's another subject that's interesting. The Polish surname Trotsky was not the one the revolutionary was born with. His true name was Lev Davidovich Bronstein, and he was born in 1879 into a wealthy family of Jewish landowners in southern Ukraine. Well, there's that southern... You know, Nikita Khrushchev came out of Ukraine, too. In the fall of 1888, at the age of 9, Lev Davidovich moved from the family estate to the coastal resort of Odessa, where he lived with his mother's nephew, Moses Filipovich Spencer, a liberal Jewish publisher. After attending high school in Odessa, he went on to junior college at Nikolaviv, where he fell in with a group of Jewish socialists. Whoa! He began to read Marx around this time and started to agitate among the fledgling trade unions in the area. He ended up being arrested, and it was at this point in his career that he decided to adopt a pseudonym. With a stroke of irony, he took on the name of his Polish prison warden, Trotsky. During the fall of 1899, he was moved to a prison in Moscow and was tried early in the following year. He was sentenced to 4 years exile in Siberia. However, before the transfer could be brought about, Trotsky decided to wed one of his fellow Jewish agitators, Alexandra Leonova Sokolovsky. I'm telling you, these names throw me. A rabbi was brought to the prison cell to officiate. Soon after the couple's exile in Siberia, a baby daughter was born, with another following in 1902. Gee, I wonder how that happened. Despite the rigors of Siberia, Trotsky was able to contribute prolific articles to the local Irkutsky newspaper, and to receive and study Marxist books. Around this time, he heard of Lenin, another communist agitator. And the two began corresponding. Lenin wrote Trotsky that if he should abandon his Siberian exile and go and live in a foreign country, friends would help him. So Trotsky found his way to Vienna, where he was aided by his fellow Jewish communist Victor Adler, and then on to Zurich, where another Jewish communist, Paul Axelrod, was point man. Trotsky's wife and children were left behind in Siberia. Oh, talk about male chauvinism. On to Paris and then to London, where Trotsky finally met Lenin at a rooming house at 30 Holford Square, King's Cross. Trotsky was immediately appointed editor of The Spark, an underground communist newspaper, which was directed at the Russian agitation. Trotsky also gave some Marxist lectures in London's predominantly Jewish Whitechapel district, and he took up with a Ukrainian Gentile woman, Natalia Ivanova Sidova. Before long, the two became lovers and produced two more male children. Forgot all about the chick in Siberia. After establishing strategy at various conferences in London, Brussels, and Paris, Trotsky and Natalia, using fake passports, returned to Russia in 1905 in order to launch the revolution. After several months of apparently harassment-free agitation, Trotsky was arrested and then thrown into the Peter Paul prison in St. Petersburg, along with two other Jewish Marxists, Leon Deutsch and Alexander Parvus Helphand. After VIP treatment in jail and a democratic trial, the agitators were exiled to Siberia once more. I wonder if he took his wife. However, after arrival in Siberia, Trotsky hardly even stooped to unpack, but merely got on a train going in the opposite direction and ended up once more with his common-law wife, Natalia, in Finland. Don't sound like they had too much security on these Siberian places of exile. Should have been prisons, I guess. I don't think they had any fencing or something. After more agitating around Western Europe, Trotsky set sail for New York, where he worked as a journalist on the Russian communist newspaper Novy Mir, out of their offices at 177 St. Mark's Place on the Lower East Side, right in the heart of the Jewish section of Manhattan. Novy Mir, New World, was owned by two communist Jews named Weinstein and Brelovsky. According to the New York police, who monitored Trotsky's activities, his main associates during this period were Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman. Well, you've heard of Emma Goldman, probably, but not Alexander Berkman. Things were starting to heat up in Mother Russia in 1917, and Trotsky sensed that the time was ripe for another Soviet takeover bid. But finance for the revolution was essential. Oddly, these so-called enemies of capitalism had no difficulty whatsoever in raising vast amounts of capital from Jewish financiers around the world. Trotsky worked on Jacob F. H. Schiff, who it was later admitted poured $20 million of Kuhn Loeb bank money into the projected Bolshevik takeover. Yeah, and they transported that money from the United States or New York up through Canada, and the Canadians stopped them and were not going to let them go through and take that money to Europe. But the American government at the time interceded and told them to leave them go. And so they were complicit in a nest egg for the revolution going from the United States banks through Canada over to Russia. Parvus, Trotsky's roommate in the executive suite of the St. Peter Paul prison, was himself a wealthy coal broker. And he was off in the Balkans making deals on behalf of the Imperial German government. Naturally, being a good businessman with loyalty only to the dollar, he had no qualms about trading with any enemy power during wartime. What's that? Well, we still got time. In Scandinavia, another Jewish banker, Olaf Ashberg, was busy putting together an investment portfolio to propel the nascent Bolshevik state into financial bliss. On 26 March 1917, Trotsky embarked from New York for Russia. He was accompanied by a good many Marxist soldiers of fortune from the Lower East Side, plus a large amount of gold courtesy of Jacob Schiff. However, when the ship stopped to refuel in Halifax, Nova Scotia, here's what I was talking about. Trotsky was arrested by the British authorities on the sound rationale that he was heading for Russia to take Russia out of the Great War and thereby increase the Germans' capabilities on the Western Front. But in a stunning reversal of how things are supposed to be, the American President Woodrow Wilson intervened with the British, and Trotsky was allowed to continue on his way since he had the advantage of the American passport. You see what rat Wilson was? He got us into World War One, something we didn't. He promised to keep us out of World War One. He got us into it, and he spent he sent Edward Bernays all over the country, brainwashing people that we had to get into the war and all that. Got war fever going. And here now he's behind the situation of sending big money into Russia via Trotsky and these people. What a war criminal. A guy that they hold up as a hero of the United States was a goddamn war criminal of the worst order. And that's what you're going to find with most of these leaders and presidents and so forth. They're crooked and they're warmongers. And you'll see Putin will be exposed as time goes on, too. Now, I know that a lot of the right-wingers who are all hot for Putin now are going to disagree with me, but I'm too much of a cynic to believe that anybody with that kind of power is going to be on our side. The Democrats under Kerensky were wise to have these ambitions, and the warrants were issued for the arrest of Trotsky and Lenin. The basis for the warrants was evidence that they were agents of the Imperial German government, a not unreasonable assumption since Lenin had been sent back into Russia on a sealed German train, and Trotsky had been sent by Jacob Schiff, a cousin of the German Minister of Interior, Felix Warburg. Remember him? I remember Dr. Crane talking about him back in the 60s or 70s. He said, here comes this Felix Warburg, Jew to the United States, supposedly a poor little Jew looking to breathe free air. Well, they didn't tell him. They didn't know he had $10 million in his briefcase, Felix Warburg. But after a short period of imprisonment for Trotsky and hiding for Lenin, both were back on the streets again. Soon afterwards, the Leon Trotsky communists led a street rebellion against the Democrats, and with just a handful of men seized control of the government. Within a short time, a delegation of Jewish communists led by Trotsky met with the Russian commanders and signed away vast tracts of Russia in return for a cessation of hostilities. However, the communist troubles were not yet over. As soon as their tyrannical regime started to bite into the newly won freedoms of the Russian people, a civil war broke out, with a white Russian army taking up arms against the communists. You know, there's celebrations going on now giving respect to the white armies that existed during that time that, you know, very little about. That was a pretty big war. In fact, Americans died in that counter-communist thing. We sent troops into through the east into Russia, and we had at least a few hundred there. Not much activity, but there was some fighting between them, and these veterans from that excursion to support the White Army are buried up in Michigan, and I forget the name of the town, but most of them are buried up there in Michigan, and their tombstones talk about how they fought under the White Army as Americans. Officially, anarchists under Nestor McNew also fought the new government and the whites with his Ukrainian army of insurgent peasants. Well, I should have joined up. McNew soon controlled vast tracts of the Ukraine. See how this Ukraine's been a problem from the very beginning? Well, one reason is the Ukraine's full of Jews. They deported trainloads of Jews early on into the Ukraine from Russia. Ukraine is an autonomous anarchist region. A treaty was signed by three Jewish commissars, Bela Kun, S.I. Gusev, and M.V. Frunz, as soon as the other fronts were secure. The Red Army then turned all its force against the Ukrainian autonomous region, and treaties notwithstanding, crushed all resistance. The charismatic McNew fled overseas and ended up laboring in a Paris factory. People who try to run usually ended up in Paris, monarchs and so forth. Some of the opposition to the communists was fueled by anti-Semitism. Oh, the whites published explicit anti-Semitic posters showing an ugly Jewish Trotsky and Oriental Bolshevik soldiers. Allegations that McNew was anti-Semitic have never been proven. In fact, he had Jewish lieutenants. Well, so did Hitler. 40-some thousand Jews in the Wehrmacht, and two or three generals were Jewish. There were some ironic twists during the bloody days of the Civil War. A Jewess, Fanny Kaplan, tried to assassinate Lenin in Moscow, and a comrade of hers did actually assassinate Moses Yuritsky, the head of the communist Cheka secret police. While the communists were busy trying to batten down all resistance to their tyranny, the Poles decided to try their luck by invading Russia. A counterattack by the Reds initially succeeded in driving back the Poles, but ended in a stalemate. The Poles, too, used anti-Semitic propaganda. I would call it probably anti-Semitic truth to counter the Jewish commissars. Trotsky made sure his various families were taken care of. His father, the wealthy landowner, David Bronstein, had been subjected to attack from both sides in the Civil War, so Trotsky gave him a job as manager of a state mill just outside Moscow. Trotsky's Gentile wife was made Minister of Museums in Moscow. His first wife, Jewish wife, was a political functionary in Petrograd, the new name for St. Petersburg. Eventually, the White Army resistance was crushed, but not before some startling setbacks for the Reds. Any further opposition was brutally suppressed by the Soviet secret police. Trotsky then turned his attention towards fomenting similar communist takeovers in neighboring countries. Events did not omen well for his venture. You know, I can go without a call for hours and hours and hours, and then when I go start to do the show, I get somebody calling up. I have to unhook the phone. In January 1919, a Jewish communist uprising in Berlin was a dismal flop, ending with the deaths of two main proponents, Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht. In March 1919, the Soviet Jew Bela Kun took over the government of Hungary, but after a bloody couple of months, this attempt also failed. A short-lived uprising in Munich under the leadership of Jew Kurt Eisner was also put down. Early in 1921, there was a mutiny at the naval base in Kronstadt. Kronstadt had always had a reputation for revolutionary zeal. The sailors had mutinied against the Tsar and also against the Democrats. Each time Trotsky had supported them. But this time the sailors were rebelling against Trotsky. So instead of defending their demands for free speech and freedom of association, Trotsky sent in Red Army units to brutally crush the uprising. To explain away this murder, Trotsky recycled the same lame excuses that he had used to smear muck-nosed anarchists, that they were in league with the White Army. Perhaps it was episodes like this that inspired George Orwell to write The Animal Farm. Soon it was Trotsky himself who suffered from such double standard morality. Lenin died suddenly in 1924, and his place was taken by Stalin. Trotsky was indisposed at the time, taking a health cure at the Black Sea. Stalin very shortly discovered crimes which Trotsky had committed, and he was exiled first to Turkestan and then overseas. Stalin eventually had him murdered in Mexico in 1940. The assassin clubbed Trotsky to death with an ice pick, a most unusual implement to find lying around in sweltering Mexico. Yeah, I believe the guy that did it was somehow either working on the grounds, or he was a janitor, or he was some type of bodyguard or something. He was able to gain access, got behind him, and put a pickaxe in his head. There is no doubt whatsoever that the Bolshevik takeover in Russia was but a Jewish takeover. As Winston Churchill wrote, another warmonger, there is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistically Jews. It is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all the others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures are Jews. Moreover, Lenin was raised by Jews, so. Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving power comes from Jewish leaders. In the Soviet institutions, the predominance of Jews is even more astounding, and the principal part in the system of terrorism applied by extraordinary commissions for the combating counter-revolution has been taken by Jews. That was from the Illustrated newspaper, Sunday, Herald 8, February 20. Stephanie Posnes of the Hoover Institute argues that, contrary to Churchill's exception, Lenin was of Jewish descent. His mother's maiden name was Blank, a most unlikely Russian name, and she was in fact the daughter of a Jewish doctor and his German wife. Both British and American diplomats in Russia at the time sent back reports describing how the vast majority of the Bolsheviks were Jewish. Reproductions and excerpts appear in the comprehensive 6 million considered by William Grimstead. I met William Grimstead years ago. He's a good man. Page after page of frank admissions by Jews themselves and by on-the-spot observers prove beyond any shadow of the doubt that Bolshevism was Jewish from top to bottom. Of particular interest to us here is the attitude of the people of the book toward cruelty and destruction. The Soviet secret police and an alphabet soup of initials, which began with the Cheka and ended up today as the KGB, of which the present president of Russia was involved in since his youth, was conceived and operated almost exclusively by Jews. The first head of the Cheka was Moses Yuritsky. His successor was a person of dubious Polish origins named Felix Zirinsky. But it was common knowledge that he was overshadowed by his nominal subordinate, I.S. Unschlicht. Over the years, control of the torture apparatus has been passed to other Jews, Genrikh Jakota, Lavrenty Beria, and today Yuri Andropov. That's about the time, too, under Andropov, that Putin came on board with the KGB. It's interesting why, you know, there were so many Jews in KGB, but so far they've claimed that Putin is not Jewish and hasn't any connection with the Jews. I would want to see a lot more on that. Yagoda's case was interesting in that he was chief inquisitor and executioner of two Jewish ex-colleagues, Kamenev and Zinoviev. Let's see here. As the wheel of fate turned, Yagoda himself was purged and executed, according to the Russian writer. You know, it sounds a lot like the French Revolution, where they just kept popping off the leaders of the revolution. According to the Russian writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the slave labor camps were dreamt up by the Turkish Jew Frankel, known as the Timber King of the Black Sea. Frankel quickly became a consultant to the Bolshevik government and advised them on the most profitable gems and precious metals to loot from the Russians. It may have been these same valuables which were sent back to Jacob Schiff in New York as repayment of his original venture capital sent over with Trotsky. Later, Frankel set up the slave labor camps as probably the cheapest form of labor supply in the world. So, you know, so Negroes cry all the time. I'm sure it was 100 times worse in the gulags, such as the ill-fated White Sea-Baltic Sea Canal scheme. In the third chapter of the Volume 2 of Solzhenitsyn's Gulag Archipelago, the author provides a rogue's gallery of the Soviet architects of the slave labor extermination program. Yakov Rapoport, Matyev Berman, Lazar Kogan, Semyon Firin, and Sergei Zhuk. Trotsky himself approved of the reign of terror that swept Russia. He wrote, quote, "Terror as the demonstration of the will and strength of the working class is historically justified, precisely because the proletariat was able to break the political will of the intelligentsia, pacify the professional men of various categories and work, and gradually subordinate them to its own aims within the fields of their specialities," unquote. That was in Avestia, the newspaper, Russian newspaper. During a speech at the International Communist Congress in Moscow, the following March, he opined, quote, "Blood and mercilessness must be our slogans." Later, he tried to and explain away the bloody slaughter of the rebellious Kronstadt soldiers. He wrote, quote, "Idealists and pacifists always accused the revolution of excesses, but the main point is that excesses flow from the very nature of revolution, which in itself is but an excess to history." Lenin, too, demanded buckets of blood. In June 1918, he reprimanded the Leningrad Soviet for being too genteel in their treatment of opponents. "This is unheard of. The energy and mass nature of the terror must be encouraged." The following month, he promulgated a new edict in Avestia newspaper to the effect that all anti-Semites were to be shot. And that means anybody critical of the Jews. Lesser luminaries in the Jewish Soviet heavens took up the refrain. Hirsch Applebaum, a.k.a. Zinoviev, penned a charming article in the Krasnaya Gazette on 1 September 1918 under the rubric "Blood for Blood." "We will make our hearts cruel, hard, immovable, so that no mercy will enter them, and so they will not quiver at the sight to see a sea of enemy blood. We will let loose the floodgates of the sea, that sea, without mercy, without sparing. We will kill our enemies in scores of hundreds. Let them be thousands. Let them drown themselves in their own blood, and for the blood of Lenin and Nuritsky, Zinoviev, and Volodarsky. Let there be floods of blood of the bourgeois. More blood, as much as possible." You see, they want to keep all this kind of information, and they have for years, generally away from the American public or the Western world. I mean, why can you condemn every day on TV and radio Adolf Hitler when you know of the crimes of these bastards, which very likely exceeded the crimes of Adolf Hitler? One would have thought that all this bloodletting would have quickly terminated any sympathy for the Soviets from their kinfolk in the West, but such was not the case. There was much in the fact of Bolshevism itself, in the fact so many Jews are Bolshevists, in the fact that the ideals of Bolshevism at many points are consonant with the finest ideals of Judaism. Right, just read the Old Testament. This is what they've been at forever, for thousands of years. Kill everybody, man, woman, and child. What Jewish idealism and Jewish discontent have so powerfully contributed to the produce in Russia, the same historic qualities of the Jewish mind are tended to promote in other countries. The New York American Hebrew on 20 September 1920, quote, "Jewish histories rarely mention the name of Karl Marx, though in his life and spirit he was far truer to the mission of Israel than most who are forever talking about it." Well, I'm going to have to cut it off, even though I've got a couple of paragraphs left here. But you get what I'm talking about. And even though that you got to keep your eyes on the Jewish EU, you better watch out for these people trying to suck you into premature adultization or whatever, eulogizing of Putin. And I've taken some flack for that. And he may turn out to be okay, but I doubt it. It seems we're always getting screwed. We run off and think somebody's going to be the big leader, the person that's going to save the race or whatever. They turn out to be phony. So anyhow, that's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Wotan's Day. In the meantime, keep your powder dry and keep your pie holes shut.